Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello, welcome along. I'm Justin Briley, your host for Unbelievable, this Saturday afternoon as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. As I like to say, it's the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together, and we'll be meeting who's on the show today in a moment's time. But if you want past programmes, if you want to look at the vast range of shows that we've got on offer, we've had over 1.5 million downloads of the show, in fact, over the last 12 months, then do go to the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can subscribe to the podcast there, see features, articles and more, and of course links to this year's Unbelievable conference, just 3 weeks away now. Unbelievable, the conference 2016. Discover your inner evangelist. We've got some brilliant speakers. Jay John is going to be kicking things off on the day, talking about natural evangelism. We've got Gary Habermas, Jeremiah J. Johnston, Tanya Walker, Ruth Jackson, Jamie Cutteridge, Yemi Adeshini, so many to mention actually. 12 speakers in all, believe it or not. Brought to you in association with the Christian Thinker Society and Museum of the Bible this year. You'll be hearing about that as well on the day. So do register yourself. Tickets are going fast, and I know it's going to sell out before the day. The tickets just fly out the door in the last week. So don't miss out if you're thinking about it and you haven't got around to booking. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable2016. And we'll be hearing a little advert that I've created for it later on in today's programme. Also going to be hearing your feedback, and of course a reminder about our EU debate coming up very shortly, in case you can actually attend that, a live debate I'll be hosting. Right now though, time to get into today's show.
You're unbelievable.
We're really looking forward to today's programme. It's a Grill Greg Kokel show. Greg Kokel is the founder of Stand to Reason, an apologetics ministry out in the States with a long-running call-in talk show associated with it. Greg regularly teaches Christians on how to engage with critics of the Christian faith. And many of the principles are outlined in his well-known book, Tactics. And he's actually coming over to the UK July the 2nd for an event called Greg Kokel Talks Tactics. It's done with Christian Heritage London. You want more information? ChristianHeritageLondon.org. Greg also has another book in the pipeline, The Story of Reality, so we'll hear a bit about that as well. And we're going to be taking some of your calls, some listener calls. We've got lots of non-Christians who listen to Unbelievable, and I've invited a few of them to put some questions to Greg across the course of the next hour or so. We're going to be hearing from Gordon, asking a question about God's omniscience and whether that makes sense in terms of prayer. I mean, why do we pray to a God if he already knows what we're going to be asking for and that kind of thing? Francis has got a question on atonement and the justice of that idea. And Matt is going to be asking about God's hiddenness. That's following a recent show where that got discussed a little bit between David Robertson and Mike Rand. Let's talk to Greg. Greg, thank you for joining me. We've got you on a Skype line, so we'll see how well that holds out for the hour. But great to have you back on the program today.
Yeah, Justin, it's wonderful to chat with you again. I just, it's too bad that it's on Skype and I'm not sitting there in merry London with you.
Well, you will be in merry London before too long.
I will.
Because you're coming over for an event with Christian Heritage London. Now, You know, I don't normally advertise events going on the same day as Unbelievable the conference, but you're a good friend, Greg, of the show. And, well, as far as I'm concerned, the more apologetics we can squeeze into London, the better.
Thank you. Yeah, nothing to worry about there.
Well, absolutely. There's room for everyone. I mean, tell us about Tactics, because that's a book you're well known for. But for those who haven't heard of it, what are the kind of principles you're going to be engaging with on the day you come over for this event?
Well, you know, there has been a resurgence of interest in apologetics in the States, and I think you've also seen that in the UK, and therefore there have been lots of conferences of very smart people giving fabulous answers to standard challenges to the Christian faith. But there's always been something missing in those conferences. Like the missing thing is kind of a bridge from the content to the conversation. Or from the scholarship, we'll say, to the relationship. And what I do in the book Tactics is provide that bridge. And so when I come to these conferences and I'm invited to speak, I'm usually the last one to speak because I try to help them take all of this information that they've received and give them a game plan that will allow them to get into play with that information in a comfortable way. In fact, the full title of the book is Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. Mm. And at the beginning of my sessions, I make a promise. And the promise I make is I will give you a game plan that will allow you to converse with confidence in any situation, no matter how little you know or how knowledgeable or aggressive or even obnoxious the other person happens to be. And I fulfill that promise because I teach them how to maneuver in a conversation in a way that is very, very simple. It allows them to stay in the driver's seat of the conversation, and it allows them to gather the information they need to decide whether they want to keep going in the conversation or not, to find out if there's an opening in the conversation. And all of it in a very congenial, relaxed kind of way, so that you can be responsive to each individual person. This is the tactical approach that I teach in the book, and it's the approach that I'm going to be teaching at the Christian Heritage London Day Conference there on Saturday, July 2nd. So I'm really looking forward to that session because I know I've done these many, many times, and I can just tell the look on the face of the people as I go through this material, they suddenly realize, well, I can do this. Mm. I can engage someone in this fashion. These are people, Justin, who have normally been sitting on the bench instead of getting into play because they're so frightened they don't know enough, or they're nervous about kind of getting to the end game of trying to win someone to Christ there in that conversation and getting them to pray to receive Christ. And I say, look, you don't have to use an American metaphor, a baseball metaphor, you don't have to swing for the fences. That is, you don't have to get a home run. You just need to get into the batting box, you know. Yeah. And I teach them how to do that, and they realize they can do this, and it has wonderful effects. People have told me time and time again how this has transformed their ability to engage people and make it a much more friendly enterprise and a lot more effective for them.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be well worth getting along to. And obviously the book, of course, available from str.org as well. You're working on a new book as well at the moment. Yes. You recently were trying to put some final put it together, at least. Not doing so well because the weather was so nice on a recent holiday. But tell us about this new book, The Story of Reality, that's scheduled to come out.
Yes, it's a labor of love. And I'm thinking of one of your old authors from the UK, John Bunyan, and how he talked about writing his own book, Pilgrim's Progress, and he said that as I pulled, it came. And so it's like pulling and pulling. It's a great way of describing the writing process. But I've been pulling now for 6 months, and I'm almost done. The book is called The Story of Reality, and the subtitle is How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between.
Well, there's just a little bit there to fit in, but I mean, is it essentially your kind of your worldview, kind of, and how that essentially informs the way you see everything, I suppose?
Yes, it definitely is about worldview, but it talks about it in a little different way, I think, than many books do. I like to think of it, though. I blush a little bit to make the comparison for obvious reasons, but I like to think of it kind of like A Mere Christianity for this age.
Mm.
I have to tell you, Justin, I blush a little bit when I make this comparison, because nobody can really be compared to C.S. Lewis. But I think of Lewis's Mere Christianity, which was a popular piece when it was given. It was broadcast on the BBC, for goodness sake. But and I think he's eminently readable. But nowadays, I hear people have difficulty with him. So this information, this basic story of Christianity, how does it unfold from the beginning to the end, from God to the final resurrection? That is a story that needs to be told for every generation. And so I've tried to use his style somewhat, his very conversational style of talking with the reader instead of just dumping out information onto the page, and trying to recover, explain for Christians who know a lot of bits and pieces about Christianity but don't have the whole picture. It's kind of like a puzzle box making an entire picture, because Christianity is a picture of reality, what the world is really like. And a lot of followers of Christ just have a bunch of puzzle pieces. They've never put it together. And sometimes they're missing important pieces. Sometimes they have pieces mixed in from other puzzles, that is, other world views, without realizing it. And so they don't have a coherent picture. My goal in this book is to capture the conversational voice of Lewis as best I can, and nobody can really do that, but and cover some of the same kind of Mere Christianity ground that Lewis covers, with some apologetics gently mixed in, so it doesn't sound like an apologetics book or lecture, to give the story of reality, how the world began, how it ends, and everything important that happens in between.
Well, as I say, quite an ambitious undertaking, but I'm look forward to reading the finished product, Greg. We're going to go to some calls in a moment's time. We're taking your calls for Grill Greg Kokel. In fact, we've set them up already. You can't actually call in if you're thinking you can. But we do always welcome your emails to the show, your thoughts after the show, and I'll happily read some of those out on a future edition of the programme. So if you want to email about anything you hear on the programme today, then do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also leave me your thoughts via the Facebook and Twitter account at UnbelievableJB to follow the programme on Twitter and let me know what you think of it. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. All the links and more, today's programme, the podcast, links, videos, articles, features from the website, of course, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. So I look forward to hearing from you that way. And we're going to be talking to Gordon as our first caller in just a moment's time here on Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, time to take our first caller on the programme today as we grill Greg Kokel. And we're going to be talking, first of all, to Gordon, who very kindly has stepped in at rather short notice in place of someone else who was due to be calling into the programme today. Gordon has a question around God's omniscience. If God knows everything in advance, well, isn't praying to God a bit of a waste of time and effort, says Gordon. Gordon, thank you for coming on the programme today. And we should say, Gordon, we know each other already. You've been on Unbelievable, but quite a few years ago now, isn't it?
That's right, yes. I've done a few discussions with you, Justin, and some other people as well. And it's always been most enjoyable. I'm always very pleased to take part in this programme because I really like it.
Well, I'm really glad you were available at short notice, Gordon. We haven't, in all the years that we've been doing the odd discussion with you, convinced you of the existence of God. But hey, we're always up for another try. But this is a particular question you've got. Do you want to just lay it out for Greg here and then we'll start the discussion between you both?
Sure. What my question is that we're told in the Bible a few occasions, but one which I'm definitely aware of is the the first epistle of John, chapter 3, verse 20, we're told that God knows everything. And in view of that, it does make me wonder, well, if he knows everything, what is the point in petitioning him? Say, for example, praying that you will pass your exams, or praying that you will have a sporting success or something like that. Because if God does indeed know everything, then he knows the outcome of all these things, and he also knows whether or not you were going to pray in the first place and what his response would be.
It is a classic question in many ways. Greg, what's your response? And we'll make sure we give Gordon a bit of time for a back and forth on this.
Yes, certainly, Gordon. Thank you for the question. And it's a little bit of a variation on the question I usually hear, but I'm not quite clear in my own mind what the conflict would be between God knowing in advance and the significance of our asking, even though he knows what we're going to ask and he knows what we're going to do. So let me give you an example. What if you were, let's say you were an employer and you had a tip-off that one of your employees was going to ask you for a raise, and you had already decided in advance that if they asked you for a raise, that you would give them a raise. But you've decided in advance that if they asked, then you would give. If they don't ask, they're going to stay right where they're at. And then the employee comes in, and the employee does ask, and you do give the raise. I think that's a circumstance that's parallel to what we're talking about, and I don't see any difficulty there. If I am going to ask later this afternoon for something from God that God certainly knows in advance that I am going to, that he is going to give to me, it is still the asking that makes the difference in the discussion. Me asking is the thing he responds to. He wouldn't respond in this given circumstance I'm talking about. He wouldn't respond if I didn't ask. Actually, it says that also in the Epistle to James, you have not because you ask not, okay? Now, God knows if we're going to ask and if we're not, and he knows what he's going to do in light of the asking, but I don't see, Gordon, how the knowledge of the thing in the future is going to somehow make the asking inconsequential. The asking is what makes the difference of what God is going to do, even though he knows he's going to do what he's going to do if we ask. So it's not clear to me what the conflict is, Gordon, and maybe you can clear that up for me.
Does Greg's response make sense to you there, Gordon?
I think that what Greg was saying was that that God's response to a prayer is dependent on the prayer being said in the first place. In other words, you have to ask before you get. I think that's what Greg was saying. Is that right?
Yes. The operating principle here is the asking, not the knowing in advance. The knowing in advance doesn't cause anything. It just means he's not surprised by what we ask. And in his own mind, he's already decided what his response will be to the question. But it is the question itself, or the request itself, that is the thing that makes the difference in God acting.
Well, in that case, given that God is omniscient, surely it's the case that God knows that you will be asking for whatever it is you're asking for. So God knows in advance whether you're going to ask for that. And he also knows what his response will be. And indeed, he knows what the outcome of the situation will be.
Yes, those are all true. They all fit the illustration I gave. That was a perfectly human illustration that matched every item exactly, but it seems makes perfect sense to us.
Well, for example, an employer and an employee, neither of those two beings is omniscient, and I don't think that would be the same type of conversation going on as a conversation between one person who is not omniscient, for example, a human being, and then a person who is omniscient, which of course is God. So the two things are not really a parallel situation.
But what I did is I stipulated that the employer, with regards to the question that would be asked in advance, the employer knows. He knows that, let's stipulate for a fact, because he's been tipped off, he knows for a fact that you are going to ask for the raise, and he knows for a fact that if you ask and when you ask, he's going to give it, the raise. But the asking and the giving is depending on the asking. For the sake of the illustration, then, it's exactly parallel. The employer's not omniscient in everything, but he knows in advance the circumstance in question. And so if this works in a human level, if what really matters is the asking, even though the employer knows the question is coming and he knows how he's going to respond, we just expand that abroad to all of God's, the things that God knows, the same principle would apply.
But in that situation, if somebody chooses not to ask for something, then God also knows in advance that the person is not going to, because God knows everything. And so if God knows that somebody is not going to ask, then obviously God knows what his response will be, whether the question gets asked or not, because, you know, he already knows how the person is going to behave, either asking for something or not asking for something.
Yeah, yes, I agree entirely with that, Gordon, but I just don't see the problem that poses. The way this is usually raised is a problem not of what is the significance of the request if God knows in advance, but is there real freedom if God knows in advance? But that's not the question you're asking. The question you're asking, it strikes me, is fairly simple, because a human illustration demonstrates that this is not an unusual circumstance. That is, it does not make the asking irrelevant, even though the one who's being asked knows in advance what's going to be asked, and he knows in advance what he's going to do. The question itself, the request in this particular case for a raise, is still meaningful, because it is the request that the employer is responding to, even though he knows in advance the question will come up. And by the same token, it is the request, since we're talking about prayer here, it is the request that God is responding to, even though he knows the request is coming, and even though he knows how he will respond to the request. Now, if the request doesn't come, God knows that as well, but then there's nothing for him to respond to in that circumstance.
I think what Greg's getting to here is he's got this parallel idea in it from a human perspective. An employer knows that he's going to be asked by his employee for the raise, and knows that if the employee asks that, he's going to grant that. And he says, parallel situation with God, it doesn't make any difference if God knows in advance. The asking is still what triggers the response, if you like. Does that help? I don't know. What's your issue here? That just the fact that God knows whether we're going to ask or not is an issue. Because why is that particular problem for you?
It's simply a problem for me, because if God knows everything, he knows if I'm going to ask for something. Mm-hmm. He knows if I do, when that will be and what it will be. Mm-hmm. And given that God knows all of these things in advance, there's no point in me, as it were, wasting my time, wasting my effort in praying to God, because it's all known in advance. If I don't pray, then God knows that I won't be praying. If I do pray, God knows that I will be praying. He knows what I'm going to ask for. He knows what he's going to do. He knows it all in advance.
I guess the response,
so
though,
no point in me wasting my time.
But then would the employee be wasting their time, say, well, I'm not going to bother asking for a pay rise, because I know that if the employer, say that the employer knew that the employee knew that the employer knew, would they then not ask for a pay rise? Well, of course they still would, because they know that it's only if they do ask that the employer will grant their request. In that sense,
well, I think yes, that's a good point. Even if the employee knows that the boss knows in advance that he's going to ask, the employee does not know what the answer is going to be. The employer does, but the employee doesn't.
Okay.
And so it is the asking that makes the difference.
Okay, the asking is what makes the difference, says Greg there, Gordon.
Yes, I hear that. But you see, the thing is that the situation is not really comparable, because in the employee and the employer situation, neither of those two individuals is omniscient, they are able to change their minds. They are able to sort of say, well, since you asked for a pay rise, I'm not going to give it to you because I think you're being rude. Even though the employee, for example, was due a pay rise. Now, that invokes the sort of changing of the mind which an employer can perform if he wants to. And, of course, the employee can change his mind. You know, he could go and knock on his boss's door and then think, actually, no, forget it. I don't want to do it. In other words,
I think what you're coming towards then is what Greg was saying he normally anticipates from this question, which is, does the fact that God does know what's going to happen mean that there's actually no free will involved in this? It's all just a kind of playing out of a play almost, you know. So kind of what's the point in that? Is that sort of more what you're getting at in that sense?
Yes, I mean, God being omniscient is not able to change his mind, because if he does change his mind, he knew in advance that he was going to change his
mind. Yes, and so the no change of mind really took place. Okay, Greg, I think we've got to the nub of this, which is, I think, Gordon saying it's not just God knowing what the prayer would be. It's that there's no kind of real asking and giving taking place. It's all been planned out in advance in some way by God.
Well, the asking is real and the giving is real. I understand that when you're dealing with an omniscient creature, it's a little bit odd in a certain way, because God, you know, the idea of God changing his mind kind of implies that he's getting new information. And so he's right that God doesn't change his mind in a really deep and profound sense. Ultimately, he doesn't change his mind, because all of the factors that were there he knows all of the factors that would relate to his own decision. How the person would ask for the raise, what time they would come in, all of the variables, and he knows what he is going to do. However, the fact remains that he is still asking, it is still the asking that is making the difference, even though the one who is answering the question or giving the request knows everything in advance. And the knowing of it in advance does not cause the asking. Here's an illustration that someone gave me once that I thought was great. You're on a dark night, you're walking down a street, and there's a lamppost on a street that's coming crossways to you. And that lamppost is causing a shadow to fall across the street that you are walking on, of a person who is walking on the street perpendicular to the one you're walking on. You cannot see that person yet. You see the shadow fall first. The shadow tells you that the person is walking and will cross in front of you in a moment, but the knowing of that doesn't cause the person to pass in front of you. And God's knowledge is the same way. He knows what is going to happen, whether the person will ask for the raise or not ask for the raise, or come to the door and almost knock and not knock, or whether he'd ask for the raise rudely or whatever. He knows all of those things, but the knowledge does not cause the thing to happen. It is the person's choices that is causing the thing to happen.
We're going to have to move on, and I'm aware you're pressed for time yourself, Gordon, and I appreciate you coming on at the last minute to put this question to Greg. Something we can pick up another time in any case. But hope that's given some food for thought, anyway, on your end as well. Appreciate you coming on the programme today.
All right. Thank you very much, Justin, and it's nice to talk to you and to Greg.
All the best, Gordon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Cheerio. Bye.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio. Grilling Greg Kokel today, back after a short break.
It's futile. No one can withstand the awesome witnessing powers of Mr. Evangelism.
You don't have to be a superhero to share your faith confidently. Join me, Justin Brierley, for Unbelievable the Conference 2016. Discover your inner evangelist on July the 2nd at the Brewery London, in partnership with the Christian Thinkers Society. And find out how you can be an effective evangelist.
With J. John, Gary Habermas, Jeremiah J. Johnston, Tanya Walker, Ruth Jackson, and many more.
Book two or more tickets and get a free Unbelievable DVD at premier.org.uk/discover. Discover Evangelism.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme. As we're grilling Greg Kokel, Greg is the founder of Stand to Reason, apologetics ministry out in the States. He has his own long-running call-in talk show there. He's used to answering questions and discussing things with people, but he very regularly teaches Christians how to engage with critics of the Christian faith. We've already heard him talking about his book Tactics. He's over here in the UK in July for an event called Greg Kokel Talks Tactics. Greg Kokel, I should say. I think it's Kokel rather than Kukul. Is
that
correct?
That's right.
Okay. I'm sure I got that wrong last time I was speaking to you, Greg, as well. But anyway, you want to find out more about the event he's doing, ChristianHeritageLondon.org. Don't forget that Unbelievable likes to bring you important conversations with various people. And if you want to find more of them, go to our website. That's premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. We'll be hearing some of your feedback as well to previous programmes towards the end of today's show, of course. You can email in your thoughts about the conversation so far as well for today's programme. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. It's always fun to have people come on the line who are not Christians but who listen to the show, and I think Francis is one of those. Francis, lovely to make your acquaintance. Thank you for coming on the line today. Have you been a listener to Unbelievable for long?
Yes, I've been a long-term listener, big fan of the programme, one of my favourites.
What inspires you as a non-Christian, as an atheist? I believe you're an atheist, to want to listen to the programme.
I enjoy hearing the other side. I don't want to listen to just people who just agree with me, because that's boring. Mm. I like to hear the challenges.
Great, and I understand you've even contributed to the Unbelievable Skeptic and Christian discussion group that's emerged, that meets every month in London.
Yes, I was one of the speakers.
Yes.
and spoke with Heather
Tomlinson.
That's right. Yes,
right.
Yes, we had an interesting talk.
Good,
about,
good.
The problem of evil.
Right. Well, Francis, I don't think that's what you're on today to ask about, but Greg's standing by to hear your question. I believe it's about the atonement. Do you want to just lay out your question and see what Greg has to say?
Yes. I'd like to ask Greg how he squares the notion of the atonement with justice, because to me there's a tension there. And I'll briefly outline why. It's because, in my view, if we've done something that deserves punishment, then justice requires that we have the punishment. So if we don't get punished, then that's one way in which justice is not done. The person who is punished has to be the wrongdoer. It can't be somebody else. You can't take somebody else's punishment in their stead and still have justice done. I mean, it happens, but that's what we call a miscarriage of justice.
Mm.
And finally, if you are going to let some people off the punishment who deserve the punishment, then you've got to let everybody off. Otherwise, because justice means that you treat everybody who is the same in the same way. And if you distinguish between some deserve punishment but they don't get it, others deserve punishment but they do get it, that's a further injustice.
Hmm.
So I see the injustice in the atonement sort of running all the way through it.
It's a really interesting question, and very well put as well, I should say, Francis. So Greg, you'll need a little chance to lay out your view of the atonement first, I imagine, and then offer a response to Francis, and we'll have some back and forth between you. Go ahead.
Sure. Here's what often happens in a question like this. These are the kinds of questions that have to be answered from the position of a worldview. What I mean is you have, when you're talking about something like morality and justice, you are talking from within a worldview. And what often happens is a person will make a challenge of another worldview based on the standards of their worldview. Okay, so for example, if you ask if an atheist asks about miracles and you start talking about miracles in the Bible, they are going to often will scoff at that, because on their mind, since they're naturalists, miracles don't happen. So that's just absurd. But it's absurd from within their story, because their story doesn't allow for that kind of thing. But when you go inside the Christian story, of course, this is a world in which these kinds of things are perfectly normal. Now, whether they happen or not is a different, whether they actually did happen or not is a different question. But the objection seems to be an objection that's based from one worldview critiquing another worldview by its own standards. And I oftentimes that's the same thing that goes on in this particular question. And it was interesting the way Frances started. She said, in my view, when you do a wrong, then you have to be punished. And if the person who does the wrong is not the one who is punished, then that is not justice. And she's perfectly right within her view. But I think one has to look at this in terms of the sensibility from within the view that is being criticized or questioned, and that is the Christian worldview. So I'm going to answer from within my worldview, that is to say, given the Christian theistic understanding of these things, is there a problem? And I don't think there is, and I'll tell you why. Because in our understanding, the one who is offended by any sin or any crime or any difficulty is first and foremost God. Even if I sinned against Francis, I am sinning first and foremost against Francis's maker, okay? So that is the person who I am sinning against principally. That's the Christian view. The debt is owed to him. So if he is the one who is owed, but he is satisfied with being paid by a substitute, if he's satisfied with that, and the substitute themselves is satisfied with making the payment, and the one who is actually guilty is satisfied with the substitute making the payment, then I don't see why there's any problem, especially when the substitute is God himself made man, who takes the punishment on himself for those that turn to him in mercy. Now, so I don't see the conflict within the context of the Christian worldview. Certainly, I can see from a perspective of justice outside of the Christian worldview that there could be a conflict. I do have a question of how justice actually works given atheistic naturalism, but that's a separate issue. And as for everybody doesn't get the same treatment aspect of Francis's question, it doesn't seem to me that God is obliged by justice to give everyone mercy when mercy is available to some. Mercy is an overflow of goodness that is not required of God. Just as if Francis could forgive the debt of one person who owes money to her, but chooses not to forgive the debt of another person who owes money. That's completely up to Francis. And by the same token, if Francis is owed a debt, and a third party wants to pay the debt of that person, and Francis is happy with that, and the third party is happy, and the person who owes is happy, who's to find fault in that circumstance?
Okay, well, that's a really good start, I think, for this discussion. We just got a few more minutes to start to tweak this out and have a little bit of back and forth between Francis and Greg now. Francis, what's your response to that?
Okay, Greg, I think you need to distinguish between a debt, which is something that justice can deal with, and something which is punishment. A debt is about the loss to the loser, and it doesn't focus at all on how culpable the person who owes the debt is. Punishment is all about the culpability of the person who has done wrong. And I think that it simply isn't enough to say, well, it's up to one person whether they forgive or whether they don't forgive. I mean, if you're a parent, I think, as I am, and if you had two children who've both been very naughty, you might say that because you've been so naughty, I'm not going to allow you this treat, you know, this visit to Disneyland you were going to have, and instead you're grounded for a month. But if you say that to one, you've got to say that to both. You can't say to one, I'm going to forgive you. I'm going to, and in spite of everything, I'm going to let you go to Disneyland, but your brother is going to be grounded for a month. If you do that, then it doesn't matter that the brother has been naughty enough to deserve not going to Disneyland and to deserve being grounded for a month. There's still unfairness there.
Yes. Okay. Greg, do you want to respond to that?
Sure. Again, I'm going to answer from within the worldview. I think there were two points that were made there. One of them is it's not really parallel to the debt circumstance. It is a punishment circumstance, and the person that did the wrong needs to be punished. But the debt metaphor is precisely the metaphor that is used in this Christian Bible to describe what our obligation towards God. And therefore, from the perspective of that worldview, that can be paid by someone else. Now, I understand that that strikes us as a little bit odd. So I'm sympathetic to that. But it doesn't strike me as inappropriate within that context. If God is the one who is offended and he decides that he is willing to take a substitute and the substitute is willing to stand in and the one who is guilty is willing to have that person stand in. As for the fairness issue and the Disneyland issue, the parallel breaks down because in this particular case, Disneyland is offered to everyone and some turn it down. So in the case of my two daughters, I could offer Disneyland to both, and one says yes, and the other one says, I don't want it. I'm going to stay home. Well, then there's no lack of fairness there if I don't give Disneyland to both, because there's a condition, and the condition is asking for it. And if they don't ask for it, but rather turn it down, then I have no obligation to give them that.
What do you reckon to that, Francis?
Well, to ask for it, you have to know that it's on offer. I mean, how do you deal with the people who never get to hear about Jesus, the people who are born in a different circumstances, grow up with a different religious surroundings, perhaps who die before they might get the chance to hear about Jesus? I mean, how do you explain the offer being made to those people?
Well, in this sense, this one's a little more complicated, and this is a very different question than what you first raised. This is a whole different issue. I guess you could say the fairness issue comes up. And to give you the quick response, though I suspect it won't be satisfying because it's so quick and I can't cash the whole thing out. But I mentioned something earlier, and what I mentioned earlier was that God is not obligated to forgive or to give mercy, or to have any debts paid at all. If a person owes the debt, then they ought to pay the debt. If God decides to let one person off and not another person, he has no more obligation than you have if you let one person off a debt to you and you don't let another person off. That's why this is called grace and mercy, because it is not obliged for God to do. Now, as to the person who never heard, they are never going to be punished for something that they never did. If they are guilty people, if they have sinned against God, even if they have not heard of the message of potential forgiveness, they are still guilty before God. And so God is fully just in punishing guilty people. If they were not guilty, of course, he wouldn't be just. But they are guilty. Everybody's guilty in some measure. And so the punishment in some measure appropriate to the guilt is going to be appropriate for God to give. Now, here's the second point very quickly, that not everybody, as you pointed out, has, Francis, has heard of the Son. But the Paul says in the book of Romans that everyone has heard in some measure of the Father. And what they do, given the revelation of the Father, which is throughout creation and available to everybody, they end up worshiping the creature rather than the Creator. They reject the Father, who is the true God, and they follow after their own fancies. Now, if they reject the Father, how is the Father any further obligated to tell them more about himself, for example, the Son, when they've already rejected the most general of revelations?
We are going to have to start wrapping up, but did you want to have a quick response before we move on, Francis?
Well, I suppose when I hear Greg talking, I'm reminded of Star Trek, and I can't remember if it was Spock or bones, but to paraphrase them, you know, it's justice, but not as we know it.
Right.
And that's how it seems to me, that it's that justice for a wrongdoing does require punishment, and the worse the wrongdoing, and if we all deserve to go to hell for eternity, then the wrongdoing must be very bad indeed. It cannot be left unpunished and justice satisfied. And if you punish somebody else, it doesn't matter that, I mean, in the case of the of miscarriages of justice, like the Guildford Four, it doesn't assist the justice of the case that four people spent a long time in prison. If we then caught the correct people, it wouldn't, you couldn't say, well, there's no need to punish them now because somebody else has already done the punishment. And that would still be the case even if the Guildford Four, for some reason, had said, we are quite happy to take this punishment in place of the true perpetrators.
Hmm.
Punishment is necessarily specific to the wrongdoer.
We're going to have to leave it there, Greg. Thank you very much as well, Francis, for being
thank
on the line.
Francis.
But as you say, Greg, for you, it's a case of you just see that there's a different way of looking at the whole issue if you're coming from the point of view of it. There being a God who has the right to say, well, I can take on that punishment for myself.
I think that is a huge part of it. Secondly, I don't see outside of God how there can be any sense of justice at all. And this is a separate question we didn't get into, but how atheism can ground the notion of objective morality, which is the only kind of morality we've been talking about. I don't see how you can get that from molecules clashing in the universe.
Well, that would be another question, but thank you very much, Francis, for being with us. So we're going to take another call in just a moment's time from Matt as we continue to grill Greg Kokel. If you want to get your thoughts in on today's programme, perhaps on this issue of atonement, then you're welcome to send it in as well. Unbelievable@premier.org.uk.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, we're going to be going to our final caller now on the show. We've been talking to Greg Kokel. We've been grilling him, in fact, doing one of our Griller Christian episodes with Greg. It's ahead of him coming to the UK in July for an event called Greg Kokel Talks Tactics, which is being hosted by Christian Heritage London. If you want more information from that, go to the Unbelievable website to find the link there, or christianheritagelondon.org. We've had Francis talking about atonement. We've had Gordon talking about God's omniscience. Another question about God now from Matt, who's calling in from the west coast of the States, but a bit further north than where Greg's located. You're a Seattle resident, I understand, Matt.
Yeah, that's right, up here in the Pacific Northwest.
Well, it's great. I always love the fact that Unbelievable reaches far and wide. How long have you been listening to the show, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been a really vigilant listener for probably the last year and a half or so. I kind of discovered Unbelievable as I was really examining my own faith. I grew up in a fundamentalist Christian denomination and was very, very much, that was my kind of my whole life growing up. And so I kind of began to question it late in life, and Unbelievable kind of helped me sort through a lot of the issues in a really constructive way, I think, being able to kind of balance both sides. And so I've been a regular podcast listener ever since.
So would you describe yourself now as an agnostic, an atheist? Do you wear a label?
I'm always a little bit reluctant to wear labels, but I'm comfortable with the term atheist as long as it's in a negative sense, that is to say, that I wouldn't make a positive claim to know that God doesn't exist. So sort of from a strict philosophical sense, I'm an agnostic in that I don't know,
sure.
But I would like to.
Yeah. So you've obviously lost whatever faith you did have from your background. There's obviously, you're still willing though to kind of come on and try to make sense of things and see if there are answers to some of the issues you have. You got in touch with me actually following that program we did between our Christian guest David Robertson and an agnostic guest Mike Rand several weeks ago, and one of the issues among many they discussed on that program was God's hiddenness. And Mike asked David the question, why doesn't God just make himself absolutely obviously plain to everyone? You know, why doesn't he just make it obvious? And David's response was something along the lines of, look, there's a sense in which God providing overwhelming kind of evidence of his existence would take away people's sort of freedom to choose God, to love God, to trust God in that sense. And you got in touch with me saying that didn't kind of work for you. Do you want to just talk us through that, what your problem is with this, what's called the hiddenness of God?
Yeah, I think in a way it was kind of at the core of a lot of my struggles kind of growing up. And I think it's an issue that deserves a lot more attention in kind of the community searching for the existence of God. Arguments like the argument from evil seem to be talked about a lot. And I think for me, coming from a Christian background, I don't really have a problem with it because there are so many theodicies out there that I think do a fairly good job of explaining why, hypothetically speaking, if a God existed, evil could still exist. Mm-hmm. And I think this issue for Christians and non-Christians is something that kind of hits home a lot more. Growing up in the faith, I knew a lot of people that struggled with this, and I did. I saw people all around me who seemed to have a relationship with God, and I didn't. I didn't feel like I did. I would pray, and I felt like my prayers kind of bounced off the ceiling, and I internalized that a lot. I thought, well, I'm not worthy. There's something wrong with me. You know, there's some sin in my life that is keeping God from having a relationship with me. Why is there this silence? So I guess it kind of, it always was something that I thought about, and then just coming back to it a few weeks ago, really, I kind of started looking at it from more of a philosophical point of view, and it seems like it's an issue that has a lot of weight. So maybe I'll just lay it out really briefly here, and then we can go from there. It seems, when I look at the world, like non-resistant unbelief exists. So that's to say that it seems like there's people, and I would put myself in this category, who are honestly seeking God and would be interested in a potential relationship with him if he exists, but they're not able to believe. So either they haven't seen personal evidence for God, either in the form of a personal revelation or an experience of God, and they also don't see evidence for his existence out in the world. But they're still not resistant to the idea of a God. And Christians also typically believe that God desires a personal relationship with each individual, so it seems like the most basic requirement for a relationship is two people or two entities each aware of the other. Mm. If someone wants a relationship with me, I need to know who they are first. And if somebody requires something of me, I need to know what they require before I can obey. So if God desires a personal relationship with each human, and if he's all-powerful and capable of communicating with humans in a clear and precise way, then why does this non-resistant unbelief seem to exist? And why does God fail to reveal himself plainly so that his mere existence is simply obvious to everyone? I guess that's the core question, and
sure.
I don't really see how free will comes into it, but maybe Greg will have something to say there.
Okay. Let's go to Greg, and then I'm sure we'll take this over the course of the break as well and continue to the end of the conversation. But Greg, where would you start with this whole issue?
Yeah, there are actually two different issues here, I think, that Matt has mentioned. And the first one, Matt, I am completely sympathetic with you on this one. I never liked, I was never comfortable with this way of talking by Christians that said, well, if God was more obvious, if he more dramatically displayed his presence, then that will somehow overwhelm our free will. And one of the reasons, I don't think that's true, is because there was a slice of history in which God apparently did that very thing. And that was when Jesus of Nazareth was on the earth and did unbelievable miracles. I mean, let's just take the gospel accounts at face value for the sake of making my point, okay? We can debate whether those things are reliable or not, but what we're doing is we're talking about a meta issue right now regarding these things. He did do those things. He controlled the forces of nature. He healed people of various diseases. He multiplied food and fed thousands. And he even raised the dead. But what did people actually do when he did those things before their eyes? Well, a lot of people believed, but a lot of people did not. a lot of people did not. Even when he, and you know John, chapter 6, when he did the Bread of Life discourse after he'd fed 5,000 people, he actually did it twice, the people turned away from him in masses because he didn't do more of what they wanted him to do. When Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, the authorities knew Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. They didn't deny the miracle, but they still plotted to kill Jesus, and they plotted to kill Lazarus. That's actually in the account. Now, all this goes to show, as it convinces me, is that if it's not the case that if only God would just do X, Y, Z, then I would believe. I mean, one wag put it, if God just appeared right in front of you, like you're asking, you wouldn't go to God, you'd go to a psychiatrist, you know. So I think what this means, Matthew, is that there is more working here than simply a rational response. Gee, there's certainly enough evidence for Christ. I should believe in him then. No, that isn't what happened when Jesus was here, and that isn't what happens now. I think the trouble with the question, if only God would do X, Y, Z, then I'd believe in him, is you could ask, you could make that requirement, no matter what it did, was that God did. Even if he wrote his name in the sky, even if he stuck his head through the clouds, there are still going to be people that for some reason or another, other than rational reason, for emotional reasons, for prejudicial reasons, for just being plain old bullheaded, are going to say no and go their own way. Even in the Hebrew scriptures, you have God present in a pillar of cloud at the day and fire by night, but the people still rebelled against him.
We're going to take a quick break, Greg, because I can tell you're about to launch into your second element of this, and I don't want to have to cut you off midway. So if you don't mind, gentlemen, Matt and Greg, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll let Greg finish his thought there and then see what Matt has to say in response. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. With Greg Kokel, founder of Stand to Reason, on the program today, taking calls from Unbelievable listeners who are skeptics of Christianity. And he's talking to Matt about the hiddenness of God, and we'll see what he has to say again in just a moment's time, and Matt's response. Come back in a short moment.
If you've ever found yourself cornered by a skeptic who is intent on challenging your faith, and you've thought, how can I answer, or what do I say, let the Christian Thinkers Society help. Our mission is to teach Christians to become thinkers and thinkers to become Christians. We train believers to understand the core truths of their faith and how to demonstrate why Christianity makes sense. Find us at this year's Unbelievable, the conference. And for Jeremiah J. Johnson's new book, Unanswered, visit christianthinkers.com and find the answers you need.
Welcome back to the final part of today's programme. Hope you've been enjoying what you've been hearing today. And just a reminder that Unbelievable, the conference, takes place on Saturday, the 2nd of July. If you haven't yet booked in, can I encourage you to do that? The tickets are going fast and I'm pretty sure they will sell out before the day itself. So I don't want you to be disappointed. We have got a little promo video doing the rounds now on social media. So if you go to facebook.com/unbelievablejb, you'll be able to see it there and share it on if you like, equally at the Twitter account at UnbelievableJB, and I'll play you out the audio towards the end of today's programme as well. But the important thing is to go to the website and see what's on offer as well. PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable2016. Something I haven't mentioned, and I really should have last week actually, is that the Unbelievable discussion group between Christians and sceptics has its meeting coming up actually very shortly, Monday the 13th of June. So please, if you're able to get along there, I understand it, they have a great time every month that they meet for just fun discussions and very friendly kind of atmosphere. And it's going to be on the use and abuse of science. It's going to be presented by Heather Tomlinson. And so if you can get along there, she'll be talking about that and there'll be a discussion. That's happening as usual at the William the Fourth Pub, 7 Shepherdess Walk. More information at meetup.com for the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic discussion group happening in London. Again, a quick reminder, reminder as well that if you're interested in coming along, there is a should we stay or should we go debate going on in Woking on Tuesday, the following day, on the 14th of June in the evening. I'll be hosting that at Woking United Reformed Church. If you're in the area, if you'd like to come along, I'll be joined by a stay and a go team. This is all ahead, of course, of the EU referendum on the 23rd of June here in the UK. So on the stay side, and we're discussing this from a Christian perspective, Sir Simon Hughes, former Lib Dem deputy leader and president of Christians for Europe, and Gary Streeter MP, Conservative MP and chair of Christians in Parliament. On the side of leaving Europe, Brexit, as they call it, Adrian Hilton, also known as blogger Archbishop Cranmer, and co-chair of Christians for Britain. Brendan Chilton is also part of the lineup. He's the general secretary of the Labour Leave campaign. He's a Catholic by background. So it should be a really interesting debate. We will be airing it on Unbelievable anyway, so don't worry if you can't get along to the debate. You will be hearing that on next week's programme, in fact, just ahead of the EU referendum. For listeners who listen to the podcast in the States, if you're not familiar with what's been going on here in the UK, we've got a big vote of our own to make a decision on soon, just as you have a big decision coming up in the autumn as well. But it's whether we should stay part of the European Union. More details from the webpage of today's show, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Okay, don't forget that after today's program, you can keep listening to hear The Profile. Sam Hales is speaking to Brian Draper, author of a book on soulfulness. And we're going to be hearing some of your feedback before we get to the end of today's programme as well. Right now, time to get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So continuing and finishing, really, our grilling of Greg Kokel on the programme today, founder of Stand to Reason, apologetic ministry out in the States. He's been taking calls and questions from a variety of Unbelievable listeners today. Matt's on the line. He's an ex-Christian. He's got a question about God's hiddenness and saying he can't quite work out why Christians would say that it would somehow take away our freedom if God were to give us overwhelming evidence of his existence. And Greg, actually, in response there, Greg, he was saying, actually, you agree. It's evident that people did have pretty good evidence of Jesus' claims, but they still didn't trust in him, believe in him, or whatever, and so on. So it's not necessarily the case that people would be compelled to believe if God just revealed himself in some amazing way.
Yes,
go ahead, Greg. You were going to complete what you were saying.
I definitely agree with Matthew's first point. And which led me then to my second point, and that is that I am not at all convinced that if there is more over what might be considered overwhelming evidence than what is already available to us, that people would then change their minds and follow him. I've seen too much in people, and I've seen them deny the obvious too much, and this certainly happened in Jesus' life itself, when he was doing these magnificent miracles. So I just don't agree with the third point, because I think it's a mischaracterization of human nature to say that if they just had enough evidence, then they would simply believe. But one more note of sympathy to Matthew, and that is when you mentioned about in your personal experience of praying and it seemed like you just got silence. I think there are a lot of Christians who have all good reason to believe in God, who experience the same thing on many occasions. And this is what is normally referred to, or is often referred to, as the hiddenness of God, that God doesn't seem to be responding when we ask him to respond. That is one of the most frustrating things about being in a relationship with God, and I struggle with it as well. It doesn't cause me not to believe in God. It causes me to wonder how prayer actually works. Because my evidence for God is quite good, and I think it's available to many people, and adequate even for those now who are asking the question. But I do think once you're in the game, as you mentioned, things don't always go just the way you want, and God is often silent to our requests, and those are hard things to figure out why.
Matt, do you want to pick this up?
Yeah. Honestly, probably more to say here than we have time for, but I'll try to be brief. I think, you know, when you talk, Greg, about the children of Israel and God being in front of them in the pillar of cloud and still rebelling, I think, you know, obviously that's true. And I think that you're right that a lot of people, if God revealed himself plainly, simultaneously to the whole world, there would probably be some people that would just refuse to believe what was in front of them. But I think many people would be convinced of the existence of God. But then I would want to make a clear distinction between being convinced of the existence of God and being convinced to follow God, because I think those two things are not the same, as is evidenced by the children of Israel and the devil, people and entities who are aware of God but yet choose not to follow him. So, I mean, my point is that I don't understand why there needs to be a barrier to belief in God, mere belief, because I don't think that the belief in God entails obedience or entails rebellion. I think once one is aware of God and clearly understands where he stands and what he requires of us, we have the freedom of choice to either choose him or reject him. And so I don't understand why God would want that barrier to be there. And, you know, to your point of saying that maybe no more people would come to God if he revealed himself, I mean, I think to say that, you have to say that not a single person more would come into relationship with God if he revealed himself plainly. And that just kind of seems like an extraordinary claim, considering the, you know, the diverse religions. They all have different conceptions of God, presumably some of which are false and some of which may be true. So I don't know. I don't quite understand that.
Okay, go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, that we are both talking about an unknown at this point. We're talking about what would people do under the right circumstances, okay? And we're both speculating from our perspective of experience. Mm-hmm. I'm just simply answering that question in this way. I've seen what people have done with enormous evidence and how they've often rejected it. I don't know what that person out there, that individual would do. But God does know what that person is going to do, okay? So on both sides, we have some speculation. It's hard to tell for sure what any individual is going to do. But as to the question of belief requiring obedience, well, it depends entirely on the thing that you're believing in and whether that thing exists. If I believed in my neighbor, that wouldn't require me to obey my neighbor. But if it turned out there was a God who was the rightful sovereign of the universe because he made everything to be under his proper authority, and I knew he existed, then the proper thing to me would be, for me to do, would be to follow him. And if I did not follow the one that I believed existed, I would be in rebelling against the proper sovereign of the universe. So the real question is, what is God's rightful claim on the world that he made?
Matt, did you want to come back?
Yeah, if we have time. I get your point, but I guess I still don't understand how. I mean, certainly it doesn't affect our free will, which I think you agreed.
Yes.
So why wouldn't God reveal himself? And if his character as the ruler of the universe was such that we would willingly follow him, I don't understand why more people wouldn't follow him.
Well, that's the question I'm not sure of, that people, if they were given just a little bit more information, would willingly follow him. From where I sit, I think the evidence is absolutely overwhelming. And the problems with atheism are so much more massive than any problems someone can think of for theism, that there's no contest between the two. And then the same thing when comparing one religion to the other. Christianity is the only religion that really makes any attempt to give solid reasons or apologetics for their view. The other religions don't do anything like that.
I mean, I do meet Greg, Christian, atheists, I should say, or agnostics, who sometimes say, look, I'd happily believe if I just had evidence that, you know, satisfied me. And I if there is a God there, if Jesus Christ is his son, I absolutely would follow. No questions asked, if I just had the evidence that I need. But
yeah,
are you kind of skeptical that would be the case?
Yes, the evidence that satisfies me or that I need was the way you put it, Justin. And to me, those are the fudge words. You know, like I said, there were plenty of people who saw unbelievable things in the time of Jesus and still did not follow and did not trust in him as the Messiah, though he had the messianic credentials.
Is it a bit like the parable of Lazarus and the man who's in hell says, if only you would go and send, you know, someone to my brothers to warn them? And Abraham says, you know the parable I'm talking about, don't you?
Right, yes. He said, even if somebody came back from the dead, they wouldn't believe. That's what he said. And I think that's spot on here. I don't know about the hearts of these atheists that you're talking about that said, if I just had evidence that satisfies me. I've heard people say that. I understand people say that genuinely. However, I think the evidence that's given them is fully adequate. This is why I think Thomas was upbraided by Jesus, because Thomas had fully adequate evidence, but doubting Thomas I'm talking about here, but then made the ridiculous request that I wouldn't believe until I stick my finger in the nail holes of Jesus' hand and my hand in the side of his where the spear went in. That was above and beyond what was really required, and I think that's what Jesus was speaking of. And I think that principle applies many times when people make these kinds of claims.
We are out of time now, but do you want to say something final before we have to leave Matt?
Well, yeah, I guess I still would want to make a clear distinction between belief and the evidence required to believe in someone or in God, and then choosing to follow him. It seems like a choice to follow or not to follow is kind of incoherent if you don't understand what it is that you're choosing.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Matt. Thank you very much for being on the line. Appreciate you taking the time to be able to call you and get you on the show.
My pleasure.
Keep listening, and I hope that the show continues to help you as you continue to look at these issues in the future.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Greg, we've had a lot of interesting different kinds of calls today. Any final thoughts as we start to wrap things up?
Yeah, there's one has to, and it's a comment I made toward the middle of the conversation, I think, with Francis. One has to make one's decision from within a worldview. You have to stand inside worldviews and assess the world from inside. Every worldview is going to have conundrums or difficulties or things we don't understand. I'm, as a human being in the world, trying to make sense of my world, I'm looking for the worldview that makes the most sense of the world, not the one that has no problems that I can't figure out. Atheism's not even in the running for me because the problems are so much bigger than anything I face in Christianity. But I do face conundrums in Christianity.
Yes, indeed. There are mysteries, but Christianity for you is the best worldview we have of explaining the world we see around us.
Right. One famous British philosopher said, if I die and see God, I'll say, why wasn't there enough evidence? That was Bertrand Russell. But there is so much evidence all over the world, and we're constantly offering that kind of evidence as apologists. So it isn't like we have nothing to say. We have lots to say. But for some people, it just simply isn't adequate, and I wonder why, because for the rational aspects, it seems to me, are certainly covered here. There must be something else going on in the minds of people who reject it.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being on the line today, Greg. Really appreciated your input, and I look forward to hearing what you've had to say when you're over in the UK as well. And again, absolutely, it'd be great to touch base while you're over. ChristianHeritageLondon.org if you want to sign up for that event that Greg's at in the UK in July. But for the moment, Greg, all the very best. All the very best for you and everyone else there out at Stand to Reason. And we look forward to seeing you in the summer.
Oh, you as well, Justin. Thanks so much.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Do get in touch if you want to comment on anything that you heard today. Perhaps you disagreed with the way Greg answered some of those questions as a Christian or as a non-believer. Perhaps you have a way of answering it yourself that you'd like to put across, or a different kind of spin on the question if you are an atheist or agnostic today. As usual, you can get in touch on social media at UnbelievableJB, the Twitter account, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to like the page and see what's going on. Email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and I'll try to read as many of these emails as I can in regard to the last couple of weeks of programming as well. Just quickly, before we do that, we released recently a promo video for Unbelievable Conference 2016. Now, I know that you can't see this if you're listening, but what I'm going to do is play out the audio, because it's got some nice music and a flavour of what to expect at this year's conference, and then you can always go and watch it in full Technicolor on the website if you like. So here's me talking about this year's conference. Hello, I'm Justin Brierley, presenter of the radio show and podcast Unbelievable, the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together for conversations that matter every week. But have you heard that Unbelievable the Conference is back for 2016? Yes, on Saturday the 2nd of July, we want to show you how to discover your inner evangelist. I'm going to be hosting a brilliant lineup of international speakers, including evangelist Jay John, New Testament scholar Gary Habermas, Tanya Walker of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, Ruth Jackson of Premier's Youth Apologetics, plus a host of others such as Jeremiah J. Johnston of the Christian Thinkers Society and Carey L. Summers of the Museum of the Bible, our partners for this year's conference. As well as plenary sessions, there'll be four streams to choose from with 12 seminar topics, including natural evangelism, how to show the resurrection really happened, Muhammad or Jesus, confessions of a former skeptic, reaching young people, and how to respond when God is silent. You'll be able to enjoy the excellent conference facilities of the brewery in central London, access a huge range of resources, and meet the speakers and other Christians from across the UK and beyond who are passionate about reaching their friends, neighbours, and communities for Christ. You don't have to be a superhero to be an effective evangelist. God calls ordinary people to do what they can where they are. So why not come to listen, learn, and interact at an inspiring day that'll help you to make the case for Christ to those around you? We'll even give you a free DVD if you book two or more tickets. So visit the website for more details at premier.org.uk/discoverevangelism. There you are, the audio from a video that we've just released up on our website. You go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable to watch it there. Equally at the conference booking page as well, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable2016. And share it on if you are a fan of the page on Facebook or follow me on Twitter. Right, let's get to some of your emails. And obviously a number of people emailing in about last week's programme when we asked, how should the church treat LGBT people? That was a discussion between Brandon Robertson, who's a young evangelical who's changed his mind on this issue. He's become gay affirming. He is gay himself. And Preston Sprinkle as well, who similarly a young evangelical but hasn't changed his mind despite doing quite a bit of research theologically into it. He felt that the conservative position continues to be the biblical one. And so we had quite a bit of people saying, hang on, what's this whole thing about? How should the church treat LGBT people? Surely there's only one answer to that, Justin. Dan Livant, for instance, says, how should the church treat LGBT people like people? Greetings from across the pond, Justin. I'm a big fan of the show and I've written to you a couple of times before, but I couldn't even listen to this episode. The phrasing of the title is offensive and reeks of the kind of arrogance and prejudice that the worst of the modern Christian community is known for. Just to be clear, I'm not gay, bi or transgender myself, but this still felt wrong to me. I'm an atheist now, but even while I was a Christian, I couldn't help but feeling that the whole LGBT issue was a big red herring. With all the actual problems in the world and human suffering around us, this is where the church feels like investing its time, energy and resources, telling people who they can and can't fall in love with. One might conclude that Satan was distracting believers from the real problems of this world, from Christ's mission of feeding the poor and helping the needy, if one believed in such things. Thank you very much, Dan. And in a similar note, Darren, who's an atheist, also says, what does it say about Christianity that you have to have a discussion about this? If the obvious answer that all people deserve to be treated with dignity and love, then what is the value of your religion? Any god that promotes or suggests hate or violence to people is a horrible god. Well, Darren and Dan both got in touch. I must admit, in retrospect, the title of the programme obviously could give the impression that there was some alternative answer to simply the one that absolutely I think all Christians, whether they're affirming or non-affirming, would say, which is, of course, LGBT people should be treated with love, respect, graciousness, as people made in the image of God like anyone else. In a sense, what I was should have said or perhaps titled the programme was, what should be the pastoral response to the LGBT community by the church, because it was more that we were trying to get across, if you like, rather than suggest that they shouldn't be treated like anyone else with respect. But the pastoral, how you would respond pastorally, obviously would be different depending on whether you felt that same-sex relationships were legitimate within a Christian framework or not. Moving beyond that, Pastor Donovan in Northampton says, anyone who holds the view that to be a follower of Christ and accept and affirm homosexuality and lesbian sexual lifestyles has developed a reprobate mind and must be rejected, as warned by the teachings of Scripture. Sadly, I think it's futile to have much debate because one key component not discussed is repentance from sin. And what is a sinful lifestyle from which we're to turn from? What is it we repent from? if homosexuality is not sinful, what is classified as sinful? Ian says, well, that was a most frustrating programme. Three observations. Would it not be more useful to have two Christians who accept the traditional view on the Bible's teaching on homosexuality discussing the matter? With the way the programme was set up, it inevitably spent a lot of time debating whether homosexuality is allowable or not. It would be really useful to have a programme which took the Bible's position as read and then could truly focus on the genuine pastoral issues. The implicit assumption behind the programme and similar ones in the past is that all people must be heard, and isn't it awful that people like Brandon are ostracised by parts of the church? However, the New Testament letters do instruct us to treat false teachers and those living in clear disobedience to God in a very serious manner. Why is no weight ever given to this aspect of the Bible's teaching? In the LGBTQ issues, there are two key aspects. One is treating the individual. The other is the harmful and destructive effects that the LGBTQ agenda is having on society and our children. But looking forward to next week's programme. Hope you did enjoy it today, Ian. And Tony says, similarly, I think most of the comments I had beyond the ones that said about the title of the programme have been on the conservative end of this. While I can't claim a degree in theology, and I'm in good company because neither did the apostles, I can read and comprehend plain language. And when I read Matthew 19, verses 4 to 6, Jesus clearly articulates God's intention for marriage. Further, he rebuffed the Pharisees when they asked why Moses allowed divorce by saying, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. But it was not this way from the beginning. When I read in Scripture every instance of hard heart, it's never good. Jesus then says, I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. Note, the exception is sexual immorality, not just adultery. Why is this statement so broad? Dare I suggest it includes other sexual expressions? So by Brandon's logic, if Jesus is okay with a progressive expression of sex, you'd think Jesus would hold the same view of divorce, since he clearly points back to the beginning as the standard for both. Where I absolutely agree is how poorly the church has treated gay and LGBT people. They are created in the image of God and deserve love and respect. I have friends and relatives who are gay. They are no different than me, a sinner in need of a saviour. Thanks you always for civil dialogue on such sensitive topics. Thank you for getting in touch, Tony. Appreciate it. Finally, just a couple of responses to the interview I aired with Larry Taunton now a couple of weeks ago. He is the man who's put out a book on his friendship with Christopher Hitchin before his death, and saying that Christopher Hitchin may have been considering Christianity in his last days. And that's met with a lot of criticism from parts of the atheist community. And here's a couple of people who got in touch about it. Richard Marlowe says, like many, I suspect that conversation left me steaming. To avoid becoming boring, I'll just echo the spot-on sentiments of Tom Jones and Val. I'm pleased to say articles in the New Statesman and The Guardian also showed Taunton in a very poor light, and it was hardly surprising that Lawrence Krauss refused to share a discussion with Taunton on Newsnight, says Richard. Peter Harris. Now, Peter Harris came on earlier in the year to do a discussion on Christopher Hitchins, you may remember, on an earlier show, and he's sort of written a PhD looking at Hitchin's anti-theism. It says, I listened with much interest to the interview with Larry Taunton and his book that claims Hitchin showed an unexpectedly close interest in Christianity during the last months of his life. I have since read the book and have added a paragraph about it to my PhD's conclusion. I am aware that the book predictably has drawn heavy criticism from Hitchin's close friends and associates, who remain wedded to the idea he remained the anti-theist par excellence to his last breath. I agree with Taunton that it's impossible to know whether Hitchin's ever surrendered to Christ's lordship before he died. All those who accompanied Hitchin's in his final hours testify he never raised the matter of God. Taunton's thesis appears to be that because Hitchin's kept two books, one as a public anti-theist and one privately as a seeker of something in which to believe, and because he performed a volte-face over US foreign policy, there's a good possibility that he privately changed his mind on faith. My response is that regardless of what Hitchin's privately believed, a refutation of his public anti-theism remains necessary, as many accept his notions as true. It may also be the case that Taunton is reading too much into Hitchin's interest in understanding John's gospel. Hitchin's was an intellectually curious man who had debated Christians many times and perhaps wished to know really what his evangelical opponents believe. On the other hand, terminal illness focuses the mind, and Hitchin's may have wanted to know if there really was something to this faith he had often derided. As far as I recall, Taunton never asked Hitchin's why he was so interested in Bible study. Perhaps if that question had been asked, it would have resolved the mystery. So the book frustrates as well as fascinates. Thank you for bringing it to my attention. Thank you, Peter. We'll have to draw a close to the emails there, but just in regard to that whole Larry Taunton fiasco, and it's generated a lot of heat, actually. Lots of people really angry about that book. I personally really enjoyed the book, but I've tried actually to organise a discussion between Larry and perhaps one of these detractors from the New Atheist community. I'm afraid all I've met with is very dismissive and curt responses. No one seems to want to actually engage with Larry about whether he's been lying or anything else in the book. So unfortunately, until someone really sits down and has a conversation with Larry about it, I think we just sort of have to, you know, look at both sides, and it'd be nice to bring them together, wouldn't it? Anyway, thank you for joining me for another show that did bring a few different sides together this week. Unbelievable. Hope you can join me again at the same time next week, doing a politically focused programme next week, and I do hope you'll be able to listen.
You're unbelievable.
Yes, a little bit different for next week, because it's going to be the broadcast of a recording of a public debate that I'm actually hosting this very week in Woking here in the UK. We're asking, should we stay or should we go? And that is, of course, because we are debating whether to leave the European Union. And we're calling this the Christian case for and against leaving the European Union. So you'll hear Sir Simon Hughes and Gary Streeter MP on the stay side, Adrian Hilton and Brendan Chilton on the go side. And I hope you enjoy it. And I hope it helps you, if you're a UK resident, to make your own decision on this very important question. In the meantime, thank you for being with me this week on Unbelievable, and I'll see you next time.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard-of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.